is Innovating Leadership, Co-Creating Our Future. I'm your host, Maureen Metcalf, the founder and CEO of the Innovative Leadership Institute, where we help leaders be future ready. Helping us on this mission today is returning guest Neil Sahota. In this multi-part series, we'll be talking about how to ensure your AI transformation is successful. Neil, welcome back.
Hey, great to be back, Maureen. Always enjoy our conversations.
Thank you. We've talked about in the first series, 5 reasons why organizations fail with AI. Now we're talking about success factors. Let's start with culture and organization dynamics. How can organizational culture impede or facilitate effective AI adoptions?
People are finicky, I guess to put it mildly. If you really think of most of the work we do, AI or not, our biggest and most frequent challenges are often people related. What I tend to see is, you know, people, most of them don't like change. And so whether it's a small or big change, you get some built-in resistance unless we as leaders pave the way, share the value and the benefits for the people. This was the real estate development industry. I was talking about the top 5 use cases, sharing the list. One guy was the CEO of his own company, said, sweet, took a photo of the list, ran off to his employees like, we're doing these 5 things. The CEO reached out to me about 6 months later and he's like, hey, I think you made all this stuff up. I'm like, what are you talking about? Those 5 use cases, there's no way anybody could do these things. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, I gave this list to my people and it's gone nowhere. And we've had some churn now for some of our top people. I'm like, I know these are legit because this is what a lot of people in the industry are doing because I've actually helped a couple of competitors do exactly these things. So he's like, then help me. And so I came on to find out, did a little triage. And what he did was he basically just told people we're doing these 5 things and the people freaked out. Some people were like, we've never done AI before. We're like, why are we doing these things? But a good chunk of people were like, if I do these things, do I lose my job? Well, guess what? You know, as much as people probably want to try and create value for the company, if it's going to cost them their job, that's the perception. Not really going to be supportive of that. They're going to be saboteurs. And that's what was actually going on. People were intentionally sabotaging these efforts. So when we talk about the importance of organizational culture, can't just hand people a list and say, go. We've got to champion and create the buy-in and establish the value proposition for why we're doing these things.
When I started the company, one of my questions and underpinning reasons for starting is highly effective consulting firms don't always generate successful transformation. They're not hired, frankly, to create transformation. They're hired to implement systems. It's not change our culture. It's not change our leadership behavior. It's not change how people think about what's valuable for the organization. Many creatives are not a big fan of AI because of the perception of it stealing their work. And so there are people who think it is Satan and giving me a list of stuff to do to enable Satan to impact my company, I'm going to find every way to look like I'm doing the right thing and undermine the thing. I may not explicitly say you've invited evil into our organization, but I'm not going to go out of my way to get it done. And so for many organizations, it's going to have a big enough impact that we'll need to change our culture.
That's the challenge. I mean, even with simple non-AI, leaders tend to take the same thing, right? That they understand the business case and the value. They, I think, assume, so do my employees, right? They often don't. Like, right? I can't tell you how many times I hear the question from people like, why are we doing this? Even early in my career, I would ask that, like, why are we doing this? I would assume there's a good reason, but I don't understand what it is.
And it's a whole lot easier to get people to move along the change acceptance curve if they understand it.
Even things that might be beneficial for us, if we feel like we don't have a choice, we don't have a say in the process, again, people will try and either block it or sabotage it. Ironically, I'm reminded of New Coke. Dating myself here, but I think it was 86 or something like that, Coca-Cola 100-year anniversary. They're going to change the formula, right? tweak it, make it better. But when the way they did this was they released new Coke, but they stopped selling old Coke. And so a lot of people felt like they didn't have a choice in the matter. And again, you're trying to fix something that wasn't broken. Obviously, sales went in the tank. People weren't happy. And so what did Coca-Cola do? They went around doing blind taste tests, right? Really addressing and trying to manage the change. They would do these blind taste tests. And so people like show you like which one you like better. And most people did pick new Coke. But when they showed them like, oh, no, that's really old Coke. You're trying to trick me. You can't use facts and science to persuade people. I'm sorry, but that just doesn't tend to work. It's an emotional response. And so the only way Coca-Cola finally got over the hurdle was they brought back old Coke, maybe classic Coke. People would buy that. But the sales for new Coke, at one point, the reputation was so tarnished, it just faded away. You know, it might have been the better product, but the way they rolled it out, the change, was extremely poor. Bad leadership and the organizational change management.
What are a couple of strategies, either in the change management space or in the culture space, to help people embrace AI and mitigate resistance?
One, it's not rocket science. Help people understand why we're trying to introduce AI, why we're trying to make this change, and focus on the benefits for them. We tend to talk more about the organization, but yeah, you know how much you hate having to spend 30% of your time reading through the claims adjustments? Well, by doing this, we're going to cut that to 5%. You know how much you hate having to fill out the same paperwork over and over again for each customer? Well, we're going to take that off your plate so you can actually focus more on the marketing message. Frame it that way. Throw a little pause in this. Second, great to think big, but start small. People already don't like change, even small change. So you want to focus on small, quick wins, things that tend to be innocuous. One way I've been helping some companies actually build that momentum is the concierge model. Now, we talk about agentic AI, these agents that can do certain things. Use a small language model, SLM. So not something big like ChatGPT, but let the AI read your employee handbook. Give it your PTO policy, your tuition reimbursement benefits. And so that if people have HR-related questions, rather than go to a portal or talk to an HR rep, they can actually get their questions answered by this HR concierge. It's innocuous. No one's going to flip out if it makes a mistake and says, will you have 19 PTO days instead of 20? It's a way for people to see, interact, but you can actually show value from that. And then you can start stacking over there. What I see is when they build an HR concierge, they'll do kind of like a branding one. We'll put something on our website. So if people want to learn more about our products or investors are interested in investing, they start building out that way. Even Jim Collins with his BHAGs, Big, Hairy, Audacious Goals, says you still have to figure out the small milestones in the journey to get to that BHAG. So don't jump all the way. And the third is really give people some training, but help them figure out things they can do in their personal lives. It creates more comfort level. Right? One of the things that I saw companies do and encourage them actually was have people write their bios using Gen AI. Plan a vacation. It's something that they can see. Yeah, it's not the end of the world. It's not going to take their job or anything like that, but they can see how to use these tools and the value they can actually get from them, even if it's small incremental value.
Back to this HBR article on how people are using Gen AI in 2025. Number two is organizing my life. This is the list of ingredients I have in my refrigerator right now. Write me a recipe or help me with a workout routine or the basics of plan my vacation. It feels safer to experiment on that than the biggest project I'm working on in my career.
It's fascinating, right? Because you kind of open up a bit of Pandora's box as we found this. So they get more and more comfortable using these tools. But again, we can't just as leaders sit by the sidelines. We also have to help them focus some of their efforts for productivity. There was a client I had. They sent all 300 of their employees to prompt engineering class, helped them understand how to write good prompts, got them all, you know, enterprise ChatGPT, And then they're telling me, Neil, we made this investment, all this kind of stuff, but they're not using ChatGPT or AI for any of their work stuff. So I started talking with them, and they're like, oh, you know, I love it. The class was great. You know, I actually do some of these things, like, you know, plan a vacation, and someone's like talking about we were actually researching potential colleges for my senior in high school, for example. And then I'm like, how come you're not using any of this for work-related activities? They're like, oh, our management hasn't told us what to do with it yet. Oh, so you're waiting for the management to tell you where to apply the tool. Yeah. And I'm like, maybe they thought by sending you to training that you would figure out ways to use the tool. And I'll never forget what people would say to me, that's not how we operate here. So I went back to the management and shared the feedback. And I'm like, well, no, we sent them that so they could figure it out. We don't know where they should be using this. And it created this weird deadlock situation between them, which was more of a cultural issue than anything else. Employees are waiting for management to give the directions. The management's like, we've never done anything like this before, so they'll figure it out. Boom, stuck.
That takes us then to the question of ethics. With AI's increased role in decision-making, how should leaders approach ethical considerations and accountability?
This stuff is becoming a must-have. People talk about the legal liabilities, these types of things. That stuff is really out the window now. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's that we have something we start calling really the trust factor. If you're not actively thinking and integrating ethical practices, and you're looking at some of these things, whether legally you're permitted to do it or not, you're actually going to sell out your own business, because if people don't have the right level of trust factor in your products and services, they will actually not do business. We're starting to see that already. So you look at things like healthcare, where, you know, some of these things are, I hate to say, kind of automated in terms of recommendations based on cost and some of the things. It's just like, where's the human factor and element in that? And they're like, well, you know, this is what we normally do. I mean, would you spend $4 million to extend someone's life 2 more months, right? Well, is that a math equation? That's what it boils down to. And maybe it doesn't make sense to spend so much if the quality of life is poor, but you're talking about then a math equation. Are you putting all these elements, right? All these ethical considerations as part of that math equation. And that's where you see leaders stumble. Going like, well, we're kind of doing it the way we were always doing it. There's a lot of tribal knowledge that would go into some of these things. They're not captured in that math equation. So if you're not actively thinking about those considerations, you are setting yourselves up to be, well, knocked out, right? Because we're seeing, especially with the younger generations, they don't have a tolerance for that. You betray my faith once and I cut you out forever.
Is there a framework or a series of frameworks to help guide people through the ethical piece? If you're stepping into new territory, everyone's going to make some kind of errors.
The answer to your question, Maureen, is yes, no, and I hate to say it that way. Is there ethical frameworks and standards out there? There's a lot of different varieties of them. You know, even our UN work, we're trying to figure some of these things out. Is there an accepted standard? Universal use? No. It's not going to be an easy thing to do. I think it was 2017 or 2018, I forget, I was asked to give a speech at the Global Symposium for Regulators. And in my speech, I put voice to what everyone is thinking about, but no one wants to talk about, was how can you define right use unless you have a baseline of ethics and moral standards? Now, think about that. It's a very subjective thing. We each have our own different kind of code. And I've seen people, you know, very viscerally react about it. No one's going to tell me what's right or wrong. And here I am putting this forward saying, like, if we're really going to try and figure these things out, really feel it's important, we have to establish some sort of global baseline. And you could see the audience, they were super unhappy. I was saying this out loud. They were uncomfortable, all these things. And when I was done with my speech, nobody clapped. No one.
Wow.
I remember one of the deputy secretary generals from the UN happened to be there, ran to the stage and said, Neil, what you said was the right thing. It was a very brave thing to do. I don't think you made any friends here. You should probably get out of here. And I did, right? So I was surprised the next year they asked me to come back. But what I noticed the next year was, you had these little hallway conversations where we were actually kind of talking about that. So he kind of got the ball rolling. And then last year at the Global Symposium of Regulators, they actually invited me back to give a speech, which I was shocked by, but they were calling me Firestarter. And I didn't really understand why they were calling me Firestarter until they kicked off the whole thing. And so while I was going to give the opening keynote, the introduction, they had, again, a person from the UN there, and she was just saying, we asked Neil to come back and all these things. We'll call him Firestarter because the entire agenda this year is based on that speech he gave in 2018. He lit the fire so they're very actively talking about some of these things now. So when I say kind of yes, no, that's where it is. And people forget that AI has a superpower. It's the one tool that we can actually ask it how to use it better. And so we talk about what are some ethical considerations we should be thinking about in using you this way, or what are perspectives we're missing or unintentionally excluding. It could actually help us figure out some of those things. So that's one of the things we should leverage is AI, bring the machine perspective into the ethical conversation.
It sounds like there are ethical frameworks probably at the national level, maybe some at the industry level, and then there's the company level. So is it like a nested doll system?
To a degree, right? Maybe subconsciously we think about these things. The problem is we don't consciously think a lot of our work, how it might have disparate impact. Same thing, like, I hate to say, like, we don't think about how we could create social good either. You're a for-profit or you're a nonprofit. It's just recently realized, well, you could actually do both. They're not mutually exclusive. But that level of thinking has not permeated our culture, our corporate culture yet. And so that level of ethical thinking that could be good or bad hasn't done the same. So, you know, kind of circling back into real estate, but mortgage lending, there was great fear in that AI could learn some of our biases and, you know, exclude certain groups. Again, you know, redlining, violating other things. But I'm a big believer in what I call the mirror image theory. For every threat, there's an equal opportunity just flipping around. And so the HUD actually started thinking about that. There was a test that was run for 3 years to benchmark this. Could AI be better and less discriminatory in mortgage lending? And the answer is yes. If the whole decision is really a math equation, let the AI plug out all the documents, just plug out the information it needs to fill in those variables. And what we found was the AI would often approve people of color more frequently and often at a lower rate than a human loan officer would, right? And some of the questions like, why is this happening? And even if you blind out the name on the loan application, we found where people were still making inferences and judgments based on where the person is moving to or what kind of job they have or where they're currently living or their level of income. And so there were all these kind of built-in biases that were slightly skewing. While one by itself may not have been too big, grouped together, it's kind of a three-mile island situation. So the HUD is starting to move towards that. Maybe that calculation should only be done by AI, not by humans.
Interesting how the ethical decision-making then kicks off a systemic response that has its own ethical loops.
It's a never-ending process, but while we have to worry about AI being weaponized, it can also be a powerful tool to bring democratization.
Especially addressing unconscious bias, I'm not choosing to be biased. I am doing it for any number of reasons based on my family of origin or bad assumptions.
We all, unfortunately, feed into stereotypes or misinformation. Like, I remember the first time I had to travel to Colombia for work quite a while ago, when I had people say, like, you shouldn't go, you're going to get kidnapped at the airport, you know, the drug cartels. And I'm thinking to myself, that stuff was like 20 years ago. You know, they've had FARC, they've cleaned up. And then I went to Colombia and I didn't see any of that. But the average American's perception at the time was that Colombia was a super dangerous place. But it was based off of what?
Mm-hmm. So let's now go on to the next category, which is communication and change management. And you alluded to change management. Effective communication is crucial always, especially during a transformation. While AI is learning from me, I am also learning from my interactions with change management. So how do we help leaders ensure that transparent and effective communication is happening throughout the organization?
That's a much larger challenge, and it goes far beyond AI, right? Because now you're talking about the trust and belief people have in the leadership. And I think that's one thing we forget. You know, we always talk about different leadership styles, and some people are just authoritarian. I'm the boss, so you just need to do it. We don't really live in an age where people subscribe to that kind of philosophy. That's the challenge. We saw this with the Writers Guild strike in Hollywood a couple of years ago. When they saw ChatGPT come out, that's when it just crystallized in their mind, the studios are going to replace us. Even though the studio says, we're not doing that, you have no plans to do that, the Writers Guild didn't believe it one bit. You say the why, and the studio's like, well, we couldn't do this, right? You add value here, the creative thinking, the original screen. Did not matter, right? The lack of trust and faith, we triggered that whole thing. So I'm glad that's all resolved, but from an organizational standpoint, that's one of the biggest things we got to really worry about. I'll never forget this, that in my IBM days, Nick D'Onofrio, who was the right-hand man at San Palmisato. So we crossed paths a couple of times for various reasons. And something happened where Nick was really happy. He's really excited. He's, you know, hey, you've done amazing work for us. That had a lot of value. I hope you're playing a long career at IBM. And I just looked at Nick and I said, Nick, I'm as loyal to IBM as it is to me. And he just kind of paused. He's just kind of shook his head like, okay, that's fair. What does that tell you about the real importance of organizational culture?
And back to that alignment and your comment about the Writers Guild. If my belief is that this is evil, it's not the right word, but if this is going to upend my entire career and ability to pay my house payment and feed my family, then I'm not going to enable it to happen until we address that as part of our change management. Not only why is it good for the business, but what's in it for each employee, then we are unlikely to get the resounding acceptance that we need to truly transform an organization.
That's the big challenge, right? We always talk about what's in it for me, but if, especially the employees are wondering, like, there's got to be some nefarious reason behind this. They're not telling us. Guess what happens, right? I look at, like, AI for good with the United Nations. A lot of people ask me, like, why did you want to work with the most bureaucratic organization in the world? And it's like, it's credibility. Right? Not only is it aligned values, but the honest truth is they're the only ones that could really have led the charge to do this. If you had some country do it, the US or China, they'll be like, okay, what are they getting out of this, right? What kind of advantage are they getting? What are the political motivations? With some company like Microsoft or Google, they're like, okay, how are they monetizing this, right? We're just built in that there's the good reason and then there's the real reason. I think the challenge that some people have is, I hear what my employers are saying, my leaders are saying, this is going to help do X, Y, Z and create this value for our company. But are they really trying to lay me off? They're trying to cut costs or, you know, we didn't have a great year last year revenues wise. So is this a way that's the dangerous thinking, right? And that's a systemic and a much larger problem in the organization, that the employees have lost faith in the leadership.
Yeah, which seems to be rampant right now.
That's the problem we're chasing. And I know it's from my own days, is we're chasing the monthly numbers. We're chasing the quarterly returns rather than investing in people and true long-term sustainable growth.
In response to what you've just pointed out, what metrics should leaders be looking at to assess if we are even ready for this change?
Well, that's the key thing, right? We always think, well, it's easy to do or learn. We'll just move forward. But much like you need the right infrastructure to use AI, you have to have the right organizational mindset, maturity level in place to actually recognize those benefits. So it's not enough to send someone to prompt engineering class. We saw that with my previous example. It's not enough to say, okay, I'm not doing this to take your job, whether they believe it or not. That's the thing. People challenges are the hardest. They're slow moving and take time and investment. And yet we want to go, go, go. So that's why I was saying, like, people are always kind of worried about more of the small, medium-sized businesses. It's easier for them to move quicker because the leadership is usually closer to the ground. And so they have a better beat on the pulse, and if they're an effective leader, can help manage that change and manage the organization and create that value for their employees to drive successful change. You're in a big monolithic company, you're basically trying to make a U-turn on an aircraft carrier.
Years ago, we would do change readiness assessments, and we would look at things like trust. If you don't trust your leaders, you are not ready to implement a major change. If you have no valid communication channels, the things you're talking about, if you've got a culture of stability over adaptability, at a minimum, your change initiative just got bigger because you've got to address all of the systems around implementing a change. It's not just a change now. It's an org transformation in support of the change thing.
That's what I think people either discount or, I hate to say this, but I choose to ignore. I was helping big grocery chains, do a merger acquisition. And you're thinking like, okay, well, store locations and overlap, and we don't need two HR departments, that kind of stuff. But it's also like, I'm the only one going there. Like, one company has a centralized business model, and the other has a decentralized business model. One grocery store, the corporate headquarters sets the inventory and the pricing everywhere. The other one leaves it to the actual individual grocery store manager to dictate that. That's a complete 180 in business models. And no one's talking about, like, now you're integrating. What are you going to do? You're going to pick one model. So what happens to the person not using that model? I'll never forget it. That all I would ever hear is like, oh, they're going to toe the line. Right? That's good business. I just think it to myself. Oh, like, this is why most M&As fail, right? They don't address the organizational and people challenges. And it's the same thing with AI. Ironically, some of these challenges have been exacerbated because people are like, well, people are more comfortable with AI now. They're using ChatGPT to plan their vacation. It's not the same thing as trying to do something at work.
So how do organizations create feedback loops to continually prepare, monitor the integration, and also address the unforeseen challenges?
The smart ones, successful ones, actually will create what I've seen, for lack of a better word, kind of a tiger change team. So they actually allocate resources, not to just help manage to explain the change, but actually to solicit feedback. And again, AI being a tool that can help you figure out how to use the tool better, they've actually set up AI bots. And so as things are going well or poorly, you could actually share with the AI bot anonymously your feedback. And so again, this goes back to how people are usually more honest with AI bot. They're getting a lot better feedback that way. And the key thing though is they're actually moving on the feedback quickly. So they're not just acknowledging like, okay, well, we got a dozen people complaining about this. If they have a handful of people, they want to go out and try and verbalize, say, look, we've gotten this feedback, we're concerned by it, we're trying to figure something out. We want people's help to come up with a reasonable solution. So they're trying to make people part of the process. It's a hellacious amount of work. And some organizations are like, well, that's taking time from them doing, more meaningful work. But those companies that are doing that, they're having a much easier and successful time introducing these changes from AI. So pay the dime for the dollars worth of work and do it.
And the reality is change is incredibly time consuming and costly.
But it's necessary. You cannot get around it, right? It's as much as like we ask the question, well, do we have the right infrastructure to support this? We should be also asking the question, do we have the right culture, maturity level to support this?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely agree. So let's now look ahead. What emerging trends in AI should leaders be aware of to stay ahead of the curve?
aside from all the things we were talking about today, if you look out into the near future, 3 years from now, we're always trying to see the shift. These high-energy interns we've created are becoming full-fledged employees. And so as a leader, you're going to be looking at literally a mix of both human and machine employees. And in some cases, you're going to have a human managing both, or you're going to have a machine managing both. You're going to have integrated kind of teams. Again, this doesn't mean that you're replacing people. It's just different sets of work. And if you look at manufacturing, they're actually already doing this. So GE has manufacturing plants where the floor supervisor is actually an AI system. And in real time, it's monitoring people's performance, assigns tasks to humans and machines, and gives them feedback on their actual work. This is going to become more prevalent as we go places. You look at customer service, you've already got some of these AI bots listening on the calls with the human agent, prompting questions, but also giving real-time feedback to the rep about their performance. So 3 years from now, you're going to be looking as leaders, a mix of human and machine. How are you going to facilitate that change, right? That's a massive corporate cultural change. Some people are going to be embracing, some not so much. If you're not already thinking about it, the honest truth is you're behind the curve on getting ready for it.
Thinking about reporting to a machine is an interesting bending of our constructs.
Machine employees don't get sick. They don't show up work hungover. Right?
I'm just thinking more like a machine bot. I get the machine employees and they don't talk back and they're not hungover. They're not tired. They're not concerned that I'm not fill in the blank. But having a machine boss.
Think about it, you're a human, you have a machine boss, and you're going through something emotionally massive, right? Maybe some tragedy in the family, for example. People are concerned, like, will the machine understand that, right? Could it be empathetic? I mean, is it still going to just expect me to suck it up and do the work?
No, that's my human boss.
But we talked about, particularly in the first part, that machines are more empathetic. They're much better to have empathy than we are. It actually might be a plus to have a machine boss.
Well, yeah, if therapy is the number one use right now, and your example of it's gone through the HR manual and may tell me I get 3 days off for sick parent, sick child. Yeah, it could send me home where the human boss tells me to get my butt back to work.
Yeah. And I mean, think about it. If the machine boss has been trained to say, like, well, we want to maximize productivity and value from our employee, that doesn't mean like we're going to allocate every second, right? We know that there's actually a lot of unproductive work by doing that. It might just say like, hey, I don't care if it takes you 4 hours or 10 hours to get this work done. I just want it done with high quality. That's what I care about. There might be an opportunity for more work-life balance that we haven't realized. Again, the mirror image, right? Every threat has an equal and opposite opportunity.
Yeah, the idea that it will take several mundane tasks off of my plate, then there's a choice. Can I have a more balanced life or do I just take on more tasks?
Yep.
You've had certainly years of doing this, but truthfully, I think decades of working with machine learning and AI, right?
Yeah, over 20 years. So now I feel old, Marie.
You're young. So thinking about your experiences, what's been the most surprising lesson you've learned about leadership in the context of AI?
That's a great question. And I think the honest truth is, as much as we like to think that we might be great leaders and we figured out certain practices and techniques, we literally don't understand a whole lot of what it means to be a great leader. Part of this has come out because we were trying to figure out, could you create an AI leader? Like Harari, one of his things is like, could you have an AI president? So we only teach AI what we understand and know. And that's one of the challenges. I don't think we understand. Leadership is always constantly evolving. Right? The workforce is changing. The world's always changing. So what works today isn't going to work tomorrow. And so how do we actually get ready to adapt? And what I really learned is that you have to be really good at understanding and, more importantly, anticipating people's needs. And that's not something we kind of figured out. It's like, how does that work with AI? Harari, in his ultimate quest for like an AI president or AI prime minister, came to the conclusion that it would be great at day-to-day tasks. Operating the country, stripping out some of the political influence so you create more fair, balanced benefits for the community. But for the larger, the big, very audacious goals, the BHAGs, for unexpected events that pop up, like, you know, a war, invasion, a famine or something, you actually really need the human leader there, because the adaptability, the agility, that's all needed. So the biggest thing right now is, it's not just that it's always dynamic, it's the pace of change of leadership. The world's entering a time we're calling hyperchange. Now, we'd experience 100 years worth of change in 10 years. It's the same thing with leadership. Your ability to adapt and change has to be nearly instantaneous now to be able to handle this. AI triggered hyperchange and has triggered the change in leadership.
The whole intent behind becoming the Innovative Leadership Institute is helping leaders innovate how they lead, not just innovate the topics that they are leading.
My buddy Peter Diamandis puts it best when he says, you got to Uber yourself before you get Kodak'd. Basically, you have to disrupt yourself before you get disrupted. We're always talking about our companies, our organizations, but it's true for us as leaders. If we're not trying to disrupt our leadership style, but again, we have to think about what we're doing today, but we have to anticipate what we're going to be doing in 3 years. When I talk about, like, hey, for your industry, these are the top five use cases that are currently going on, you're like, well, we're not doing those things, right? So they're like, great, we're going to go run and try and do those things. And it's like, while you're doing those things, your competition is leapfrogging ahead of you because they're trying to do the next things, right? And so to be an effective leader, an innovative leader, you'd be thinking about, what's the next set of things I should be doing as a leader to be successful?
Even more interesting is Steve Jobs developed things I didn't even know that I was going to think I needed. How do we help move the field of leadership forward so that we have to offer the things leaders need so they don't have to be an expert in leadership? They can continue to come and learn.
Yeah, that's where your institute, I think, proves invaluable, Maureen, because that's where you're really helping leaders do. And again, if you're wondering where the whole world might be going, your organization might be going, where leadership might be going, AI is amazing at scenario planning. We as people suck at it, but AI is amazing. So if you want to anticipate what might be happening, you have a powerful tool to leverage, and then leverage the institute to figure out how you chart the path to that 2 or 3 year future. Adapt your leadership style and make it a reality.
Thank you for that plug. And the partnership of the two of us and our organizations really does bring to bear the AI expertise and the human expertise for clients to have insight into the future and insight into the leadership and implementation. So, Neil, for our listeners, how do they find you?
Well, please visit my website, which is just my name, neilsahota.com. If you're looking for the latest, greatest information, especially tactical things for your organization or your life, check out what I share on my Substack, which is neilsahota.substack.com. Of course, you can find me on social media. Feel free to connect and follow me.
Thank you for your brilliant insight. I so appreciate the depth of experience you have across the broad range of topics, not just AI and what's happening in the machine learning space, but also practical implementation, real client stories, and understanding the broader context of leadership and the humans who are being swept into this cycle, some terrified and some really excited.
My pleasure to share, Maureen. But hopefully this gives people the little nudge to take that next step.
And thank you to our listeners for joining Innovative Leadership, Co-Creating Our Future. Are you interested in elevating the quality of your leadership? The Innovative Leadership Institute offers best-in-class leadership development, executive advising, and org transformation services. Send me a note at inquiries@innovativeleadership.com. The world's most successful leaders are created here.
Hi there, this is Morgan James. Every album represents a step in an artist's journey. Hello, music lovers. I'm inviting you to listen to Music Journeys with Mike Foley. Mike mixes music and conversation with artists to share what informed and inspired their latest project, how the love of music began, what music means to them, and so much more. We've chatted about three of my projects, the most recent being Soul Remains the Same, a soul album of songs you would never expect. You can always expect the perfect combination of music and stories on Music Journeys. The show airs Saturday afternoons at 3:30 on WCBE. Recent episodes are available on the major podcast platforms and the WCBE app. To meet and hear more from all the musicians featured since its start in 2018, including me, to be the first to be featured three times on the show, look for Music Journeys on WCBE's podcast experience at WCBE.org.